Blog Talk Radio.
Developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and I'm also here with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those who are with us live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. Eagle One, he'll be riding herd as usual, so if you have some questions or comments, or if you wanted some clarifications on anything that we bring up or a host brings up, go ahead and roll that into the chat room, and we'll bring it into the show. And if you're new to MidRats, or if you missed some shows you want to catch up, you can always reach our archives over at Blog Talk Radio or set yourself to get the podcast on iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. For those that read what we put up on our blogs about the show, our goal today was to talk about two things, because we spent a few weeks talking about COIN. We were going to discuss the other side of COIN, what there may be some of the down parts to it, with Colonel Douglas McGregor. We've had some challenges getting the two lines to meet, so we may not have Colonel McGregor on today. If we do, we'll bring him on at the bottom of the hour. However, our second guest is coming on today to talk about what we're looking at on the far side of the Pacific. We have on as our first guest now, Michael Austin. He is the Director of Japan Studies and the Resident Scholar in Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, but he doesn't just talk about Japan, and we're going to talk about all things East Asia. Misha, welcome to MidRats.
Thanks very much, Sal. Appreciate your having me on today.
We're really glad to have you. Also, thank you for your flexibility here to step into the breach. Just coming off something we talked about just shortly before the show started, just to get the conversation rolling, pretty much people talk about Asia. We've been distracted for the last decade because we've been obviously focused on Central Asia, the Middle East after the events after 9/11 in 2001. So here we find ourselves going on a decade later, but a lot of things have developed and changed. If the last time somebody really seriously looked at it was 2001 or 2002, with the relationships for Japan, Korea, China, Taiwan. As you're looking at that part of Asia, if there were three big areas that you've seen a shift in that significantly affect us in the U.S., what would those three areas be?
That's a great question, and I think you phrased it just right in terms of all of the major changes that have been happening. You need a chalkboard, really, to lay them all out. I think if you were trying to boil it down to three, I would probably say the first is trade and economics, and I'll go into that in a second. The second is the growth of multilateral institutions, and then the third is the worrisome trend in the security balance of power. On trade and economics, everyone obviously knows China is increasingly one of the most important countries in the world economically. It's in many ways the engine of Asia, both in terms of its imports as well as its exports and its manufacturing. But the rest of the region has been just as vibrant over that time. And it's really changed the way that over the past 10 to 15 years or so that the world does business. We're all used to it now. But if you went back, to 94 or 90 or so, it would be you'd be looking at a different world and not so sure about expectations about economic growth. And now we see that the globalization in essence, has really taken root in Asia. The problem is that the U.S. is not keeping up. And by that, I mean not only at home where you look at the hollowing out of industries and the loss of skills, but on the political side as well, the fact that we have been lagging, particularly under the Obama administration, in trade policy and taking advantage of all of the different types of economic development that's been going over there to benefit American workers and the American consumer in the long run. The Asians have been signing numerous free trade agreements with each other for the past 10 years. China has signed one with the nations of Southeast Asia, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, known as ASEAN. Japan has been slow but is trying to catch up with its own agreements with ASEAN. Korea and Japan are trying to move forward on free trade agreements, and the U.S. has been stuck. You know, we signed a free trade agreement with Korea, which would have been the biggest and most important one, 2.5 years ago, and it hasn't been ratified by Congress, and it's still languishing there. So as Asia has changed economically and has become a major source of research and development, a major source for American companies outsourcing, obviously a producer of all the significant goods that we're using. We've benefited, but we have not made ourselves as much of a partner in Asia as we should. So I would say that's the first big change that we need to really start thinking about more carefully, both in terms of policy as well as in terms of where we stand on competitiveness in America. Second, I would mention multilateral institutions. You know, one of the big problems, I think, for Americans as they look at Asia is that our template, when we think of international relations or international politics, is Europe and post-war Europe. And so we think about, you know, sort of automatically, we think about a NATO, or we think about a more effective set of multilateral institutions, whether you like them or not, such as the EU, the European Union, or before that, the European Community. And even the big influence in multilateral institutions of the UN, you know, coming from European countries. And none of that exists in Asia. So for Americans looking over there, it's a huge, enormous realm, and depending on how you want to define it, and we can talk about that if you'd like in a second, there's no NATO, there's no EU or AU, you know, Asian Union, and Asian nations certainly are part of the UN, but really aren't the major movers in the UN. So how do you get your mind around thinking of dealing with it in a multilateral and a political way? What has happened over the past 10 years or so, to frame it in terms of your question, is that the Asians have started very hesitantly but with increasing speed to try to link the region together. It goes nowhere near what has been accomplished in the EU, and you know, some would argue that's a good thing. There's nothing still like a NATO, but you have a bunch of different organizations, many of which come out of the ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. They have an Asian Regional Forum, and that's actually the annual meeting at which Secretary Clinton made her now famous comments about the South China Sea a few weeks ago. There's something called the East Asian Summit. There's an ASEAN plus three process, which is ASEAN plus China, South Korea, Japan, and extending it out to India and Australia and New Zealand. So there's lots of different things that are beginning to percolate through the region. But, again, the U.S. has been far behind the curve in really being involved. And while we do send our representatives to the ASEAN Regional Forum or the ASEAN meetings, the Asians, when you talk with them, complain repeatedly that the U.S. is really missing in action. We're not there. We're not working with our friends and allies. We're not pushing forward our own vision of Asia that, you know, we would have to work on with them or negotiate. But rather, we are increasingly letting the Chinese dominate or determine the agenda. And you have a lot of countries that are worried about that and are trying to balance out China or even hedge China. And they find it hard to do when the U.S. doesn't even participate in the East Asian Summit, which is really the biggest gathering. We prefer to work through APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group, which has really been an underperformer in recent years. So on the political side as well, Asia is changing. The countries are attempting to come together slowly and hesitantly, and I can go into more detail about the things that they talk about. But again, the U.S. Has been very busy in the region, but behind the curve, and I think that that's hurt us. And then finally, and probably the thing that, you guys are most interested in, and maybe most of your listeners, and probably best known, is the changing security environment and the changing security equation. There's no question that we face in Asia today that is dramatically different from 10 years ago, and even more so from 15 years ago. When you think back to 1996 and the Clinton administration sending in two carriers to the either side of the Taiwan Strait in response to China's launching of ballistic missiles off the coasts of Taiwan when there was a presidential election coming up, China interpreted that very clearly for what we wanted them to interpret it as, which was, you know, we're not going to allow you to bully other nations, including our treaty partner Taiwan, in this way. But China took it to heart, and over the past decade and a half, has continuously built up its capabilities so that it would never be put in that situation again. And if you talk to, as you guys know so well, if you talk to folks in the Navy or you talk to folks, you know, in the national security establishment here, the U.S. would be extremely wary about doing something like that again. And the calculations that we really didn't have to think about back in 1996 in terms of anti-access or area denial, the submarine force or the like, and the ISR capabilities of China, their ability to know where we are and where we're going, have just exploded. And so we face a real change in just the baseline of what China is capable of doing and our relative decline vis-a-vis China. What you factor in on top of that is what appears to be, over the past couple of years, an increasingly aggressive Chinese posture, a calculation, as far as we can tell, on the part of both the political and military leadership. Now that they have some of these capabilities, more submarines, more surface ships, better ISR, much expanded air capabilities, that they're going to start pressing their claims. And they have done so repeatedly throughout the region, particularly in the South China Sea, where they've acted unilaterally on a whole host of issues, from fishing areas to their own claims of what exclusive economic zones, how those should be determined, to you know, mini shows of force, sailing flotillas through international waters, but very pointedly around Japanese islands, placing them in between Guam and the Philippines, obviously expanding the whole range of exercises that they do. And the U.S. has been attempting to figure out a balance and a way of maintaining the political preference of relations with the Chinese military, with the PLA and mill-to-mill relations, which have basically been put on hold by the Chinese, and maintaining our capabilities. And that is an area in which all the countries in the region look very, very carefully at what we are doing, not just what we're able to do, but what we actually do with what we have. And there are increasing concerns, I think, voiced to all of us who travel through Asia about the long-term staying power and credibility of the U.S. in the region. So I think in a somewhat long way to answer your question about the big three things that have changed over the past decade or decade and a half, it's that economic momentum, it's the political momentum, and it's the security momentum, all of which I would say to some degree have been moving against us.
Eagle One.
Well, there have been some recent, since Secretary of State Clinton gave her speech about the South China Sea, there have been some more, I guess, no more recent incidents or current incidents where China continues to press claims adverse to some of our allies. For example, the recent incident off Indonesia where they were fishing in the Indonesian exclusive economic zone and then sent what amount to a patrol craft to protect their fishing vessels, I guess, from the Indonesians.
Yeah.
You know, and they always go back to this 1947 map, which they claim the dotted lines encapsulate their legitimate claims to the South China Sea through the Spratlys and all that. Can you kind of go through that? And is this just they're able to do this because we are so much weaker that they've decided they can do this, or is it their aggression in this area or their aggressive positions in this area because they've grown so much stronger, or is it some combination of the two?
Well, I think it's a combination, and it's been going on for a while, and you're right to refer, it's hard on the internet radio to have a picture of the region, but obviously the South China Sea is one of the world's most strategic waterways. It has some of the most important sea lanes of communication through the Malacca Straits and the Lombok Straits. It is the highway for everything that's flowing from the Indian Ocean, from the Middle East, from Africa, all the way through up to China, Korea, Japan, obviously all of Southeast Asia as well. There are 100,000 ships a year or more pass through those waters. Actually, just had the figures on the tip of my tongue, but it's around that. It's an enormous amount, hundreds of ships, if not thousands of ships per day. It's also, as has been increasingly discovered in recent years, a mineral-rich, a resource-rich area of the world with lots of natural gas and oil reserves and ultimately other types of deep-sea minerals and seabed minerals and the like. So it's coveted by everyone. You have about 11...
Hello, Colonel McGregor. Can you hear me?
You have about 11 different nations that are claiming different types of territorial rights, and you have sets of islands that are really just rocky outcroppings that all of the different nations, China, Taiwan, Vietnam, Brunei, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, all claim as their own territory. These are the Spratlys and then also the Paracel Islands, which are a little bit more up north. And China has, since the 30s, if I remember correctly, drawn what they call the cow's tongue, which is basically a line of dotted or dashed line around the area, slightly in the interior of the South China Sea, so away from the direct territorial waters of any of the nations there, but claiming that inside this cow's tongue, because that's what it looks like on the map, is all Chinese territory. Now, for 40, 50, 60 years, they didn't do anything about it. Now they've started to assert that this truly is their territory, and they've done two things. They've not only asserted it, they've begun to act on it. Their assertions have come much more strenuously and much more bluntly and boldly. In fact, two high-ranking Asian officials of the Obama administration, I'm sure as many of your listeners have read or remember, were told last year in Beijing that the South China Sea was now a core interest of China. And China has only referred to things in areas like Taiwan and Tibet as core interests before. So it was putting that claim at the very highest level of national interest. Now, whether or not they would do anything about it is separate, but clearly, rhetorically, we're attempting to mark territory and put the United States on notice. Now, what they've done to back that up is, as you've mentioned in the first part of your question, is be increasingly aggressive in terms of intervening in areas where they have interests such as fishing interests. So they now send out armed patrol boats, either from their Maritime Services Administration, Maritime Safety Administration, which is their equivalent of the Coast Guard, or sometimes directly PLAN vessels, although it's mostly the MSA, the Coast Guard type vessels, that go out and accompany patrol with the fishing boats. They have also declared no fishing zones unilaterally in areas that they claim are theirs and have captured numerous other countries' fishing boats. And this year alone, I read at least one statistic, though I can't vouch that it's absolutely correct, that they have arrested or detained somewhere on the order of 300 Vietnamese fishermen. And Vietnam has been probably in the forefront of opposing China's claims as well as its unilateral actions. So all of this has really been ramping up. And of course, a year ago you had the harassment of the USNS Impeccable and a sister ship that were doing surveillance or reconnaissance activities, oceanographic mapping and the like. They were approached by a collection of sort of motley little flotilla of fishing ships and some MSA ships, and really were just doing very, you know, low-level yet dangerous harassment of coming very close to the boats, throwing debris in the water to foul, you know, to foul the lines and the like. You've seen that with us. You've seen stronger actions as well. A few years ago, a Chinese Song class sub, one of their SSKs, basically slipped within the protective screen of the USS Kitty Hawk when the Kitty Hawk was still out there, and surfaced within torpedo firing range, basically just you know, say we're here and we were able to do this, and then left. So they have clearly been what I think is probing and pushing across the board, bullying and direct action against the weaker countries that they know can't do much about it, and very, I would say, coordinated and certainly well thought out probing of us to see what our reactions are and see if we move the markers. This has led to a lot of different reactions. On the one hand, you have the nations in the region finally starting, and I think in a probably what's a bad way, finally starting to beef up their own capabilities. Now, on the one hand, we want nations in the region to be more capable. We want them to take care of their security and defense, but we don't want them to do it out of fear that the U.S. is no longer a credible power. And so you see that Vietnam is buying 6-kilo-class subs from the Russians. Singapore has a couple of subs. There is the recent reports within the past 2 weeks that Japan is going to increase the number of submarines that it has, you know, again, concerned about not only air, activities near its home waters, but its shipping going through the South China Sea. So you see a lot of activity on that end, on the one hand. And then on our end, for whatever reason, the administration finally decided that it was going to make this very public, very blunt statement that the peaceful resolution of territorial issues, including EEZ issues, in the South China Sea was a national interest of the United States. And China did not react well to it. But we, I think, have moved, I wouldn't necessarily call it a turning point, but I think we've moved into a period or a moment where we will no longer ignore what's going on, or at least it is increasingly harder to get away with ignoring what's going on. The big question is, where do you go from here? You know, on our end, once you make this claim, how do you back it up? What's your policy actually going to be? And on the other end, how far are the Asian nations going to go with this mini naval arms race, and what are we going to do about it? How is that going to fit with our policies and our plans? How are we going to deal? Are we going to be on the same page with friends and allies? And what type of reassurances will we give to other nations that are worried and feel that they, such as Vietnam, and feel that they need to bulk up their own capabilities without really having the type of political mechanisms that would allow them to settle these problems with China? Meaning, you may have a lot more subs out there, with the potential of bumping into each other or you know, surfacing suddenly and raising tensions without the confidence measures. So anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Misha, we have a caller on the line. Jerry, you're on Mid-Rats with Misha.
Hey, Dr. Osland, this is Jerry Hendricks. How are you today?
Jerry, how are you doing?
I'm very well. You know, your final comments are actually the part of the question I wanted to ask, which is, okay, now we've reached this turning point, and we have this recognition that the United States can have a role in this. If so, you know, what direction do we take? One, with our allies, do we look for greater access and cooperation with the Philippines? How about Vietnam? And if we're going to dedicate some force structure to it, you know, what recommendations would you make so far as the size, shape, and characteristics of that force structure to operate in the South China Sea. One of the questions that I teed up on another blog was, you know, is it time for something like the Africa Partnership Station transported to the South China Sea, some sort of a hub that we can work with our allies and coalition partners in that area? What are your thoughts along that?
Well, that's a great question, Jared. Thanks. I was actually just out at PACOM last week, and they are, I would say, you know, just beginning to digest what all of this may mean, and probably, as far as I could tell, waiting for Washington to clarify how far they wanted to go. I think to back up at one level and just mention one other thing on the political side before going into your really good question is, you know, we put our chin out here, and I think it's the right thing to do. I mean, you know, I think we have been quiet for so long in terms of really letting people know that we, you know, we've been out there for a long time and we patrol regularly, but, you know, we really do expect that there are certain behaviors and patterns that all the nations need to adhere to. So I think from that standpoint, this was the right message to send. The problem is that we have to back it up now, and we have to be very clear that if we have said this and we don't do it, everyone out there is watching. And if you make the statement and you don't follow up, you know, with action on it, and we can talk about what that action should be, then I think you lose more credibility than if you didn't say anything at all and people could say, well, you know, it's a strategic ambiguity, for example. I mean, we are unambiguous right now about the South China Sea. So where do we go from here? I think that is the biggest question I have for the administration is once they knew they were going to make this statement, what did they expect would be follow-on? Because you didn't hear anything other than this aspirational statement, basically, from Secretary Clinton that we want to have a multilateral mechanism for resolving this. What we did not talk about was any of the things you mentioned, Jerry. We did not talk about increasing specifically with regard to this, at least I didn't hear it, cooperation with allies or with other interested nations. We, you know, what the Obama administration has done, and I think they should be given credit for it, has been attempted to reassure nations in the region that, as they put it, the U.S. is back. I don't think we were ever gone. I just don't think we were ever particularly focused on what we were doing there. And they've tried to give the impression that they are back. And you look at Assistant Secretary of State Campbell or Assistant Secretary of Defense Gregson, they are there constantly. They are working with the allies all the time. What I don't think we've heard, though, is the bigger strategic vision or articulation, meaning exactly the questions you asked. Are we going to propose a new initiative for enhanced relations with the Philippines? Are we going to try to get, I mean, I don't think anyone, and certainly out of PACOM, there was no one who felt that we were going to be able to get permanent basing back in the Philippines. But can we come to some agreement with them where we could have, you know, access? Are we going to even propose that, where we could look at some of the airfields and possibly some naval installations that would give us access when needed? With Indonesia, the administration, I think, did the right move by lifting the restrictions on contacts that we can have with the Indonesian Special Forces. But there has been very little movement on an overall political agenda or security agenda with them. Again, talking with some folks out in Hawaii, their feeling, as expressed to me, is that the Indonesians just aren't ready. They don't have yet the internal capacity to deal with these questions. They haven't come up with their own national security strategies. They wouldn't be able to really work with us at that level. But without initiatives from the U.S., there will certainly be no push factor on them. And then Vietnam, as you mentioned, I mean, Vietnam is probably the most intriguing country there right now, I think, with, you know, continued political relations with the Chinese because they're both, you know, ostensibly communist parties. But without question, the keenest sense of feeling pressure from the Chinese and looking to other nations in the region as well as the U.S. to take a role. And we haven't had initiatives there. So from that perspective, from the political military side of it, I think that we should absolutely be coming up with some set forward-looking recommendations to at least propose to these governments and say, hey, you know, can we do confidence-building measures with you? What type of – are you ready for some type of joint training? Can we just increase officer exchanges? What is it that would get you to be a little more – or get us to be a little bit more involved with you and start maybe priming the pump for some more serious discussions? In terms of force structure, you know, Jerry, you're the expert on that, and I, you know, would honestly hesitate to wade in to say, you know, this is what we need. I mean, what I was, again, told out at PACOM is, you know, concern over the fact that steaming time is down in the region, that we are just not, and you know how big the region is, we are just not able to be around as much as we were before. And I certainly know your prescriptions for getting a much more flexible and smaller force down that's able to visit and be present. And I think that's certainly one way we need to go. You know, visiting there, though, I do have to say that people get impressed with you know, the big ships that come in. I mean, they like to see the flat tops in there. They like to see big displays of the U.S. Coming in. I'm sure they'd be satisfied with other things. But that's when they really feel that we're living up to our statements that, you know, we are going to be the underwriter of security and we do have a stake. So I think whatever type of force structure that we're contemplating, and it might be, you know, if it were ever possible, forward basing another carrier out in the region so that we could have more presence from that end, that I think goes a long way towards giving us credibility when they are wondering, you know, are the Americans going to be showing up, you know, regularly or when we need them.
This is Sal again. Another country in the area that has had some really interesting things in the press recently, in the Australian press, really in the last year, there's been some really interesting articles and discussions about what they need to do for a post-American era. Because, you know, the Australians, at one point, they really leaned on the protective nature of being part of the British Empire. And as Britain power waned, the U.S. stepped into that breach. And there's always a little bit of insecurity at the Australians from a cultural and ethnic part being in Asia. And they're looking at not only our waning ability to project power in Asia relative to the growth of those powers, but they're very concerned with our economic future and the debtor-debtee relationship that we have with other powers in Asia. Where do you see Australia and, to a lesser extent, New Zealand? Have you had a chance to read some of that thing in the Australian press? Or how do you see, from their context, they may react to the changes in U.S. power structure relationships?
Yeah, I have. And in particular, I think you're probably referring to the white paper on defense that came out last year or so, maybe 18 months now, where it explicitly talked about, you know, an Asia in which the U.S. was less of a presence. And I was down there about a year and a half ago or so, maybe 2 years now, and talked with folks at their Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade and Defense and the like. And clearly they are... you know, they have the same problems that we have. You know, China is their biggest trading partner. It is crucial for them. China's coming in and buying enormous amounts of their raw materials, so it's very important for the economy. But they also feel pressure, and they feel the non-diversified nature of that trade relationship, where they don't want to have all their eggs in one basket with China, and there were the big problems with Rio Tinto, the mining company, and its stake in China, its position in China, and arrests of some Australian nationals in basically what was a fit of pique on the part of the Chinese. So there's a lot of concern in Australia. At the same time, there's a recognition that this is an absolutely essential economic relationship. You know, the sense I got when I was there and talking with them is that they really want to keep and feel that a lot of the problems are, you know, far away from Australia. You know, their part of the ocean is a little bit more peaceful. When you start talking South China Sea, it's getting closer to them. But, you know, they're concentric circles. By the time, you know, you get up into Taiwan Straits or you get up into Northeast Asia, it's pretty far. The Australians are you know, just phenomenal allies. Everyone knows that, and I can't think of anyone else we really want to have on our side, you know, politically and even with the force that they can bring. The fact is that, you know, the Australian forces are pretty small. They're pretty limited. There's certain things they can do, and obviously what we do a lot with them is intelligence sharing, it's situational awareness, it's a lot of discussions on the overall structure of relations and trends in the region. But in terms of the types of activities that we would have, you know, we don't have any troops down there. We have fairly limited missile defense cooperation with them. We don't have a lot, I think, that we could say, you know, the Australians can necessarily bring to the table, other than the very important factor of their being a liberal nation, a nation that has worked so closely with us, that has good relations with Japan. We have a trilateral dialogue between Japan and Australia. And I think, if anything, what you've expressed and what you asked about in terms of Australian reactions is really just an important bellwether. You know, I think when you have a country and a friend that is as close as Australia is raising questions like this and stating that it's going to increase its defense spending because it's worried about our presence, then that should send some really strong messages to Washington, and Washington ought to listen. I also think, you know, we want Australia as involved as it's able to be, involved in PSI, Proliferation Security Initiative, for example, obviously continued close cooperation on the intelligence side and information sharing. Ultimately, I think, you know, we may want to look at some ballistic missile, some closer ballistic missile defense cooperation with them. But I think what I would prefer, if we were really talking about, you know, where do we go in the next 10 to 15 years, is to begin thinking about moving beyond hub and spoke, you know, our hub and spoke alliance relationships, where, you know, we have formal treaty alliances with five nations in the region, Japan, South Korea, Philippines, Thailand, and Australia. But it's all bilateral. It's one-to-one. And to really get more creative, aggressive, if you will, about looking to expand that into trilaterals, quadrilaterals, minilaterals, so that we're not always having to do a patchwork between what we've agreed with Japan and now how does that fit in and what we're concerned with Australia or Korea or the like. In a way, it's the obverse of what Jerry asked. Jerry, you know, asked what should we be doing to reach out to the other nations in Southeast Asia, and the short answer is a lot more. But at the same time, we have these long-standing partners, Australia, Japan, and Korea, foremost among them. And I think we should, after 50 years, be now thinking of a new era where we really try to explicitly make a more multilateral, liberal alliance of nations that is going to look forward, identify the common threats, look at common security strategies, maybe even get down to those questions that Jerry asked about force structure and posture and how we can leverage off each other. So Australia is a crucial part of the mix, but again, on a bilateral basis, there's only so much that it can do.
Eagle One.
Well, you've mentioned a lot our relationship with Japan, and in looking at some of your writings over the last few years, we seem to have wandered down a rocky road with them, too. How do things stand today?
Well, it's a great question, because in a way, I think the answer is, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And yet at the other side, there are some really long-term changes coming in the pipeline that we need to be prepared for. You know, we've always had problems with Japan, as much as it's been, and I think it's true, that it has been the linchpin of our Asia-Pacific strategy. Just given the basing structure that we have there, that continuous forward deployment of American forces and materiel, the only forward home-ported aircraft carrier, and the importance of the 7th Fleet, of the 5th Air Force, everything there, and of course the Marines on Okinawa, make it unique in that perspective, and especially once we lost the Philippines back in the early 90s. Without Japan, we just don't have a credible position, I think, strategically and certainly from the operational side of things. We would be so far out of the theater of operations that it would change most of our calculations. So for us, we are, in a sense, I don't mean this in a negative way, but, you know, we're stuck with Japan. You know, that's where we have to be and have to operate from. The Japanese, in their own way, are stuck with us as their only ally and their only, you know, true partner in the region. So everyone you talk to, Washington, Tokyo, wherever you are, knows that. It's in the DNA. And you may have political folks come along who don't get it initially and rock the cart and cause some short-term troubles, but pretty soon things get settled down because the reality bubbles up to the surface. So back in the 90s, you had the Japanese all worried about Bill Clinton bypassing Japan, trying to create a new strategic relationship with China. And by the end of Clinton's term, he had signed, even before the end of his term, he had signed probably the most sweeping deepening and enlargement of the alliance back in 1996-97 with the roadmap for alliance transformation, which was just the revised guidelines in 1997, which were just essential to making Japan step up far more in what it was doing in terms of providing support of looking at questions of when it would be able to intervene. It has all these constitutional issues I can talk about, but when it could intervene, how it would support us, the responsibilities, roles, and missions, and the like that it would undertake. And what we saw in the last year was on the Japanese side, a new politician come in, Prime Minister Hatoyama, who resigned a few months ago, a month ago or so, who didn't get what the alliance was all about and started an unnecessary process whereby a 2006 agreement we had to shift Marine forces around Okinawa and shift some of them out to Guam and move some air wings around and the like, and squadrons around and the like, he called that all into question and tapped right into this very deep vein in Okinawan politics that has been anti-American and anti-alliance and the like. So that caused a year's worth of problems. I think what you're seeing right now is the slow settling down of that situation. The problem is that while politically I think we are pretty much back on the same page, and I think you hear that in Tokyo and you hear that in Washington, the actual resolution of this issue, meaning how do we move the Marine Corps Air Station for Tenma fixed wing and rotary craft out of Futenma and up to a northern part of the island, and then allow the headquarters of 3rd MEF, 8,000 Marines and their dependents to move over to Guam, that is still not resolved. And we're not out of the woods, and in fact, I think we're going to have a lot more trouble down the road, both trying to come to a final agreement on what the configuration of the new facilities for the Marines will be up in the north, as well as dealing with continued local opposition in Okinawa. My fear is that this agreement could still fall apart, and if it does, I think the unnecessary tensions of the past year, meaning it would have been hard enough to get it, you know, going even without the political intervention of the former prime minister and his problem causing, but if the agreement does fall apart, then what I'm worried about is that the last year has really strained the working relationship, and everyone's trying to get back to the same page and really attempting to work hard, but there's a lot of bitterness, particularly on the American side. There's a lot of bruised feelings. The Japanese did not take kindly to being publicly dressed down by Secretary of Defense Gates in October of last year. If further difficulties come up, if the agreement really does fall apart, I'm worried that the political relationship is already, I don't want to say weakened, but it has been stressed, and that it would be far more stressed. And that brings us right back to the beginning, which is, but we really have no other choice. The one refrain you hear both in Washington and Tokyo, which is certainly not a strategy, but the one refrain you hear is, we have to make this work. Now, ultimately, that's true. But there is a lot of water in between the agreements and, you know, finalizing them and getting us into this transformation. And right now I'm worried about how we're going to accomplish that over the next year.
I'm glad we brought the subject up to Japan, because I'm going to throw a little love to our friend Jerry here. When Jerry came on, it got me thinking. Jerry wrote what I consider a very good book on Teddy Roosevelt.
Absolutely.
And as a result of his book, when James Bradley's book came out, The Imperial Cruise, I snapped it up right away. If I was smart, I would have read Jerry's Facebook post that he put on, I think, the day after I bought the book. My timing was bad. But I read it anyway. And I found James Bradley's book incredibly disappointing. I won't go into the reasons why besides this. Part of his book I found to be rather patronizing, insulting, when it talked about Japan and the relationship between the U.S. and Japan from the opening of Japan really through the beginning of World War II. Because when you look at it in a broad scope, besides that uncomfortable era of disagreement between in the 30s and 40s, there really is a special relationship between the U.S. and Japan. And a question I have for you is, if you're familiar with Bradley's book and what he talked about in that relationship, is that a view that is held in Japan, or how does Japan view America's, lack of a better word, responsibility or catalyst to bringing Japan into really the Western sphere of how the world operates in many respects?
Yeah, it's a really a good question, because that was the what I wrote about when I was teaching Japanese history, and I wrote a book on primarily the 1860s, a little bit on the 50s and the 70s, that talked precisely about this. I have to say I have not yet read Bradley's book. It's on the to-read list, but that list, as you guys know, just keeps growing every week. So
I suffer from that problem too.
Oh man, I just have not gotten to it. But the overall question of the U.S. bringing Japan in, the old way we talk about it, we still talk about it, Commodore Perry opened Japan. I mean, now you got me started on the history, but I'll just say, Japan was always open in its own way, and it had its own way of doing international diplomacy that was based on traditional East Asian models that flowed out of China. And so Japan was never a closed country. What it did was very, very tightly regulate the types of foreign contact that it allowed, and these were when the samurai were ruling the country and the last family, the Tokugawa family, that ruled the country. So when the Americans came in, they didn't come into a hermit kingdom. They didn't come into a closed country. The Japanese would call themselves closed because that allowed them to say to anybody who wanted to come in, no, we're closed and we'll tell you where and when you can come. So it was a policy on their part to do that. When the Americans came, they found a country that had very long established traditions, and yet because it had these long traditions and had had to respond to lots of different changes in its international system, meaning China and Korea and Southeast Asia and the like, that it was very, very flexible, and they were very quick learners, and very quickly began to discern the ways that Western powers negotiated with each other. That's in fact the subject of what I wrote about. And the book I wrote was actually called Negotiating with Imperialism, the way the Japanese negotiated with imperialism as opposed to just surrendering as we all think, which is really, really not the case. So this is already, long before Theodore Roosevelt sent out his around the world cruise, that you had Americans and Japanese working together to, in essence, bring Japan into the community of nations. Now, the Americans were clearly pressuring the Japanese, there's no doubt about it. But the difference was, with the Europeans, that both the Japanese and the Americans saw themselves as the harbinger of the future. Meaning, in the beginning, it's true, the Japanese resisted the Americans and the Tokugawa family resisted the Americans, but even they figured it out pretty quickly, started to sign treaties, and in 1868 they were overthrown, and a new modernizing, centralizing government, the one that the Roosevelt mission encountered came into being. So you had the Americans who saw themselves as, you know, the New World, separate from Europe, separate from the old-style colonizers, and this was before we had the Philippines, so we didn't see ourselves as colonizers. We saw ourselves as bringing a New World to Asia. And very quickly you had the Japanese feel that same way, that they were the only Asian nation that could modernize or had chosen to modernize, because they looked around them, they saw China resisting and they saw Korea resisting. They saw all the other nations in Asia just sort of stuck in this lassitude, and they were dramatically transforming themselves. So when you ask, was there a special relationship, the answer is yes. And it was because both nations identified with one another as the future, as young, as remaking, in the Japanese case, remaking themselves, and in the American case, being basically the successor of Europe. What we didn't have was a particularly close military relationship, and we didn't until after 1898, really, when suddenly after the Philippine War, or the Spanish-American War, when we take over the Philippines and we get Guam and we get Hawaii, suddenly in one fell swoop, America is a Pacific power. Now, Japan had in one way actually been very comfortable with America before that, because unlike Britain, which had taken territory, and France, which was taking territory, and Russia, which was trying to take territory, the Americans didn't seem to want territory. So until 1898, the Japanese felt very comfortable with us, and our relations were primarily on the technological end. You know, the Japanese were learning about tariff rates from us, and they were learning about educational systems from us, and farming and agriculture was very important. But they did look to the Europeans on the military side, and they looked to, they looked primarily to the English for the navy, and they looked to the French for the military army, the land-based side, until 1870, and then they switched to the Germans, not surprisingly. So they were really aware of what was going on and who was, at the top. 1898 really changes that. You have Japan a few years before that, of course, defeat China in the Sino-Japanese War, attempt to take over Korea and other parts of China, and basically being kicked out by some of the European nations, Germany, France, and Russia, in what was known as the Triple Intervention. That set Japan and Russia directly on a clash that, would result in the Russo-Japanese War in 1904. But the Japanese now were becoming colonists and colonializers and imperialists. They had taken over Taiwan, which was then known as Formosa, and they were clearly focused on acting like the imperialists. And then suddenly you get the Americans. So after 1898, those good feelings begin to wane between the two countries, and it's also supercharged in the first years of the 20th century by the immigration conflicts that we have with Japan, where we attempt to restrict Japanese immigration and put the Japanese in a special class and the like, which was a huge insult. I mean, here, from their point of view, they are the only Asian nation to modernize, to westernize, to look like the West and act like the West, and we still were treating them as though they were savages. So between, in the space of about a decade, from 1898 to 1907 or so, you have a real downturn in U.S.-Japan relations, and both countries begin to get fixed feelings of wariness towards one another. And it's only a few years after that, I don't have the exact date, but it's only a few years after that, the U.S. Navy basically begins wargaming scenarios against Japan that really ramp up, as in the 1920s, War Plan Orange and all of those things. So that by the time 1941 hits, we've had decades of this increased tension between Japan and the U.S., the sense on the Japanese side that the U.S. has ignored their rightful position in the world, the sense on the U.S. side that Japan has simply sought to replace one set of empires with another empire, and Nimitz and Spruance and Halsey and all of those great admirals who suddenly find themselves out now fighting the Japanese have been wargaming this for 20 years. And they knew exactly what they were going to do against this country that 30 years before, you'd still have goodwill visits from Japanese admirals to Annapolis and the like.
Yeah, I think the performance of the Japanese, especially the Japanese Navy, in the Russo-Japanese War just brought a lot of respect to them and made everybody kind of look seriously at what they could do. Eagle One, you got the next question.
Okay, well, speaking of war games, we just had some off the coast of Korea. What's your view of what's going on with North Korea at this time and their usual burning sea of fire kind of threats against everybody?
Well, that's exactly it. You know, it's the usual from them. You know, the biggest concern is why did they sink the Chonan? I just read a report this morning that they detained or captured a South Korean fishing vessel, so I think we all better keep the headphones on for the next couple of days and see what happens here. The question is why? Why this egregious escalation? And once again, because of the way that we approach North Korea and we and our allies approach North Korea, I don't think there's any other way to put it but that they got away with it. I mean, I don't see that they've paid any price for it. As usual, we went to the UN and wasted months and got nothing out of it. Didn't even get new sanctions. You know, if you're into diplomacy, then you can say, yeah, we got a presidential statement that didn't deny the North Koreans did this. I mean, yeah, all right, that's about as low-hanging fruit, I think, as you can possibly get. So nothing happened, and our own exercises took months to occur. I mean, the sinking happened back in March. We've only just done them in, the first week in August. So if you want to send a message, I think, you know, time itself is of the essence, and we did not send it in a timely manner. We may believe we did, but, I'm not so sure that it's perceived that way. Secondly, of course, is location. We did not do it anywhere near where the sinking happened, even though that was all of the scuttlebutt initially, is we're going to go right there and say, hey, you know, you've got this northern limit line. We're going to operate there. We're not going to let you bully us. Well, for whatever reason, either because the Chinese said don't do these exercises in the Yellow Sea, don't bring in a carrier, for whatever reason, we did these exercises, on the complete other side of the peninsula. And so, again, how is it interpreted? As just chest beating on our part or not? And we certainly, you know, don't know what the North Koreans think about it because they're wary enough and wily enough not to say anything. I would notice that if I read the news report correctly, and you guys might have read it, so please correct me if I'm wrong, that the fishing boat that was captured on the east side of the peninsula. So, again, that's just where we had these exercises. So if the point of the exercises was to say, hey, no more mischief, we're here, and, by the way, we happen to be doing it on the east side, and then 2 days later the North Koreans go on the east side and capture a fishing vessel, you know, you just have to look at what was the efficacy of the whole exercise. And what Washington officials have said repeatedly, both publicly and privately, of course, is that they're going to continue in a series of exercises at our place and time of choosing, which will include the Yellow Sea. It will include aircraft carriers and the like. I certainly hope so. I actually believe that the Defense Department has, or at least PACOM, has all good intentions to do that. I just don't know where the Washington OSD, DOD, White House side will come down on this. And so if you asked where, what's going on with North Korea, I think the real question is what's going on with us, because I think North Korea is doing what North Korea always does, although they did step it up dramatically and tragically in the case of murdering these 46 South Korean sailors, completely unwarrantedly and in the time of peace. But that is, in a way, par for the course for North Korean actions. The real question is, what are we going to do about it? And so far, to me, the answer seems to be very little.
Well, everybody, our guest for the entire hour today was Dr. Lawson. Goes by Misha, for those who talk to him on internet radio. And thanks a lot for taking an hour with us today. If the listeners wanted to read more of the things that you've written about Japan or Asia national security in general, where would be the best place for them to go?
Well, first, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it, and always happy to talk with you guys. For where I write, all of it's collated at the AEI website, so it would just be simply www.aei.org/Auslin, A-U-S-L-I-N, and it's got everything there. The Wall Street Journal column I write comes up a few days after it's published, and any of the other things are there. And then also we have a blog that I blog on, which is blog.american.com, and I try to bring in the Asia and some of the maritime stuff there as well.
Outstanding. Thanks again, Eagle One. Appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for coming in live and being in the chat room. Join us next week. Hope you have a great Navy Day.
Thank you, Dr. Roslin.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Brandon Piccadilly.